This is an example of speech.
All our history of broiling
well,
wars.
Tell me what to think. A free from oversight and free of charge. Thoughtfully improvised, expletive deleted, details expanded, whistle blow hard, evergreen topical heat wave of a weekly conversation turned podcast, in which we discuss politics, global affairs, current events, music, literature, social media, and anything else that bubbles up from the unmoderated comment sections in our brains. We urge you to join us and tell us what you think. You can contact us at tmwttpod@gmail.com. I'm Peter Albro. You can contact me on Twitter at @bloatednemesis. And I have with me, as always and forever, Charles Minnick, who is on Twitter at @green_weird, which is W-Y-R-D. This episode, we have weak thoughts about tariffs, Scandinavian propaganda preparedness, a hip-hop test drive, new albums by three legendary MCs. Okay, four legendary MCs. In closing thoughts, where we catch up on what the U-Lines are up to, and a remembrance of Anthony Bourdain. Prepare to get righteous and reactionary. This is Tell Me What to Think. Time to get on our soap pod and tell you what to think. Now, for some weak thoughts.
From the ivory tower. Waste your life in a struggle for power. All men thus reduced to please. So fucking just do whatever you please for the night commuters.
All right, welcome to Tell Me What to Think. This is Weak Thoughts. If you'd like to contact the podcast, you can hit us up at tmwttpod@gmail.com. You can find me, Peter, on Twitter at @bloatednemesis, and Charles on Twitter at @green_weird, W-Y-R-D. How are you doing, Charles?
Good. Another beautiful day in Wisconsin.
Yeah. Is it beautiful down by you?
It's overcast, but it's not cold.
Okay, yeah. It looks like it's raining, but it's not. Like, it has...
Yeah.
It's not cold, dirty. Though. You can find stories we're going to talk about on the podcast at #TMWTT. You can find us on Google Play, Apple Podcast. Leave reviews there, because that's, like, the main official place podcasts exist. It's like you have to like review there. It's like a rule of podcasting, I guess.
Wait, what?
iTunes or Google, I mean, or Apple Podcasts, whatever it's called.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just because it's still the main place where people get podcasts. So if you can get more traction there, it helps, even elsewhere.
Yeah, blast our podcast.
What was that?
Oh, blast. Telling these people to blast it. Just leave whatever review you can, even if it's like two stars. Like, man, I hate this voice.
Yeah, like as you're rolling through the neighborhood in the summer too. Roll down the windows, turn on the podcast super loud. You know, give it to the people for free.
More than we do.
Yeah. What else? Any other business, with that stuff? No, you got to do all that. That should be good there. So I was reading a comic book last night called Uncanny Avengers, and it's after, like, most of the world's mutants are killed, and, there's some mutants left, and Professor X is dead, and Cyclops killed him, and,
I got dark.
Yeah, and, like, spoiler warnings if you haven't read comics in the past 10 years, which I'm just kind of catching up on a few now. I was like, wait, how did Cyclops kill Professor X? He's probably already been brought back to life. The mutants were killed by... It was a really roundabout, long story, but by Scarlet Witch. She kind of went crazy. And, you know, her dad's, like, Magneto. Like, first she, like, created a reality where, all like, Magneto rules the world for mutants. And then, like, as she came out of that reality-shaping hallucination, she then reduced the world's mutants down to, like, 190 or something.
Holy cow.
Yeah, and I can't remember if they died or they just lost their powers or I don't know.
Genocide.
Anyway, so they're trying to form an Avengers that has mutants on it, and that is called like the Avengers Unity something or another, and it's specifically trying to help promote Professor X's vision, but using the Avengers, because even though Cyclops has kind of became this bad guy, something he said to Captain America, which is like, you know, you guys have never backed us, to Captain America. He's like, you never helped the mutants. You guys always just turned your back on us. That stuck with Captain America.
Wow.
Yeah, no, it's pretty powerful. And that's kind of where I'm going with this. And so this first storyline features, you know, a few of the X-Men mutants, and it's like there's interesting little plot lines with like taking down an old picture in Avengers Mansion and putting up one with Professor X, and then the Wasp like gets like annoyed by it. It's really cool. But anyway, so Red Skull is this villain, right? Old Captain America Avengers villain, and he like takes Professor X's brain, and now he has all these mental powers. Yeah. Well, he has this little crew with him, and one of the people on his crew, who was first introduced in this first comic, is called Honest John, the Living Propaganda. And it's like the coolest villain ever. Essentially, he can go even on TV or in person, and he appears as who you would want to see as like the most believable leader.
Weird.
So like in the first scene he's in, you see like these different TV screens, and to each person watching, and like I had to reread it a few times, I'm like, wait, what's happening? To different people watching, he appears in as different races. So he appears, you know, like they keep it really simple because they keep like the suit the same, although even dress could kind of appear differently. But it's like a black guy to, I don't know, I guess it was black people and an Asian guy, and I don't know if it was to eat, like necessarily the race that the person was, but he just appears as the person you think you would believe propaganda from.
Wow.
And he's spouting super divisive racist propaganda on behalf of the Red Skull, anti-mutant propaganda. So Red Skull is now like an anti-mutant guy because he's like, oh, they're a great scapegoat. Essentially, he's like, they're a great scapegoat. We can unite under our fascist New World Order against
right,
mutants.
And take out potential competitors.
And this was written in 2012. And I'm like, if someone wrote this in 2017 or 18 in the wake of, you know, the national political discourse, they'd be like, oh, he's mirroring, you know, the current events and stuff. This dude, they wrote it 4 years before. I mean, obviously, comics has a long history with, you know, it's essentially sci-fi.
Right.
You know? But I don't know, it really stuck out with me. Like, oh my god, they have some guy spouting racist propaganda to divide the nation under some brutal fascist dictator. This sounds...
Yeah, to be fair, that started in, like, 2010.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's not... I mean, obviously, Red Skull's based on, you know, the Nazis were from the 40s. I mean, so it's not like this is totally novel, obviously, but... I just love that in 2012 they were making a like a super villain with propaganda powers. And, yeah, I don't know. And so... really, I don't know. It stuck out to me, and I thought I would just say that to the audience as a precursor to all the other things we're going to talk about, which probably have some sort of propaganda element to them.
Not our show, mind you. The stories we're talking about.
No. Yeah. Well, definitely. So... Where do you want to go first with this? I mean, I suppose kind of like this G7 thing. Let's get that out of the way since it's already over with.
Yeah.
But I mean, so Trump pisses off a bunch of people there at the G7 thing, and it's all over these tariffs. It's all over these, is it these 232 tariffs?
Among other problems, like, it's just the various tariffs that he's trying to impose. But the 232 tariffs against Canada are kind of egregious because they're national security tariffs.
Yeah, which yeah, on Trudeau its face doesn't make sense.
Yeah, Trudeau rightly was like, Canada's no threat, and they are not. They are our closest geographical and cultural ally.
Yeah, I mean, like, I bet there's, like, a decent amount of Americans that think Canada's part of the United States.
Yeah. I mean, if NAFTA progressed beyond trade talks, we might have had a Northern American Union, like the EU, but thankfully that didn't happen.
Yeah. So, what are the 232 ones? Are those the ones that are based on national security, or...?
Yeah, they're, the Trade Authorization Act, Section 232, it's like, we can impose a tariff, or the president can, almost unilaterally, be based on national security concerns.
So that's a false pretext, right? They're not actually doing this because of actual national security concerns. That's just the way that they are able to do it unilaterally through the White House.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They're just pulling the levers that they have access to.
So is Trudeau just, like, being, like... like, is he making a mistake by arguing over national security about this, though? Because, no one really thinks it's about that. Because Trump doesn't pay attention to rules and laws and the reasons for rules and laws. And so, like, if you're arguing, isn't that a mistake, like, so many in America have made, which is like, but you can't do that! That's not the purpose of this, and that's egregious, and
well, this is the best way that Trudeau could form a political line of attack without it being directly directed at Trump himself, which would just kill all further negotiations.
Okay, yeah.
Like, this is the most diplomatic way of saying it's bullshit.
Yeah, I mean, and he did get the message across, regardless, that it's bullshit.
Right.
Yeah.
But you don't call him bullshit.
Yeah. Although, that might be... that's how they responded to him. That's how the White House responded to Trudeau, which is to personally attack him for that. Like, in his attempt, in your explanation, to not personally attack the president, but still get their point across, the American's response was... what is it? Like, that Peter Navarro, the trade envoy dude?
Oh, there's a special place in hell for people who stabbed Donald Trump in the back.
And I think Trump himself called him, like... I'd have to find the tweet, but he tweeted something that was a personal attack on Trudeau.
I mean, that Peter Navarro's line, though, that was...
Yeah.
Easily the most egregious thing I've ever seen. And to think that guy's, like, conducting diplomacy, like, even negotiation... How do you sit down in a room with that guy after he says something like that?
Like, a guy who talks like that should not be involved in trade. I'm just going to go ahead and say that.
Maybe not even theology.
The one thing I think I wanted to ask you, though, brought up in our pre-show email chain was... how does this fit in with... because that's been my... as I've been watching this news, I'm like, okay, it fits in with the narrative of Trump being, like, an erratic leader, clearly. I mean, anything can fit into that narrative, really, until he starts being consistent. So it's a really easy narrative that I don't find very helpful when trying to think about the White House and the administration. And also because it's not just him. Like, yeah, he's probably... coming up with some ideas and overruling some others, but there is a whole, like, infrastructure around him of people and bureaucrats that does kind of have a coherent policy and way of doing things. So how does this fit in with other things they've done based on the economy or national security?
Oh, these tariffs specifically. How do they fit into their broader economic agenda?
Yeah, and pushing them on to a country like how does that? How does doing this to Canada fit in with? I don't know, America First. I mean, I guess I kind of see the America First side, but it also is like, how does it fit in with, like, the tax scam? You know what I mean? Like, it's pissing off those people.
I mean, it's kind of imposing a corporate I won't say, it's tough to even say it's a system, but if you look at it, like, the tax scam was directed kind of to benefit corporations and their executives. These tariffs will in some way benefit American corporations. Like, they'll have an easier playing field in their in the domestic market than foreign competitors.
Mm. Yeah.
So, I mean, it tangentially works for the workers, sort of, but this is aimed at Trump's and the Republicans' corporate sponsors.
Interesting. American corporate sponsors.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was actually listening to something recently about tariffs back in, like, under Taft. And they actually were sort of making that point of how tariffs can help business leaders in the country because they're not really, like, in a broad, like, macroeconomic sense, it might hurt their bottom line, like, over the long term. But it's not, like, all of that extra cost goes on to consumers.
Yeah, especially in the long term. In the short term, they just get to charge slightly more and still be ahead. Like, a lot of this boils down to a complete failure for American companies to innovate, other than, like, pure fucking financial instruments. Because Germany has a perhaps arguably even higher tech manufacturing economy, but they don't ship their jobs overseas. So what are the Germans doing that's so much better than what the Americans are doing?
Hmm. I mean, and it's worth noting, I don't think Germans, I would be shocked if they like had a lower kind of average wages and salaries.
No, the point is coherent, Ivan. Sorry.
Is your cat disagreeing with you?
Yeah, seemingly, or he's there. Or he's begging. Ivan, you have to innovate on your own. You can't just keep beggaring the government for a handout.
But yeah, I mean, so like Germans... So you're saying like the jobs that in America would be viewed as like ones that would be too expensive to have here?
Mm-hmm.
And we ship overseas... The Germans are not doing that.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah.
Because they have national infrastructure, or national programs and like apprenticeships and things that encourage companies to keep their workers and to keep them highly skilled and happy.
Hmm.
And their companies do well as a result of it. I mean, this is just short-term, like, cost gouging.
Yeah. Hmm. So... Do you have anything to look ahead on that in terms of the world economy and geopolitics?
I don't think we're going to get invited to another G7 meeting anytime soon. I'd be surprised if they let Trump in the room again. I mean, admittedly, they have to on some level because he's the American president, but there's nothing useful to be gained from speaking to him.
Yeah. What do they talk about?
Well, a lot of it is the opportunity for these leaders to be in the world to, you know, do informal negotiations. But then a lot of the time is just spent, like, prepping the statement that they come out with at the end of the summit. Like, hey, tariffs are bad, okay? And we're going to – we pledge to spend this much on avoiding trade isolationism and – yeah.
That makes sense why there was all of this hubbub about this final statement.
Mm-hmm.
There's sort of an inside baseball thing going on with, like, even, like, I think I'm a good example of someone who's, okay, I feel like this, like, existential dread over our president, so I'm probably reading more news stories about things that I wouldn't have. Shit, even under Bush, to be honest. I'm like, but there's like an inside baseball thing that journalists aren't great at explaining. Like, I read these articles about this final statement thing. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, we won't include him in the final statement. Trump's like, I think they'll include me in the final statement. But no one explained why the final statement was important or like how it was you know, like a big part of the whole summit, the point of the summit.
Yeah, it's kind of the point of the summit. It's like, here's what we agree to.
Yeah, so does it, would the, might they invite America back, but not him?
Like, well, like, you can't do that.
Why?
Maybe they just want to hold these meetings? Well, because Donald Trump is the ultimate arbiter of American foreign policy. And it's like notionally the G7 heads of state. So he is, however temporarily, the head of state.
Is it to give that statement, that kind of unity, more credibility?
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, I mean, okay, we're living in a weird time where our president is not our most competent government official. And at times, it may have been one of the more, maybe not most, but more competent government officials with some past presidencies.
Certainly, certainly one of the more authoritative government officials.
But So, I don't know. I'm just thinking, well, if they're actually hammering out some things, why don't we just send, like, some, like, deputy secretary of blah, 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 because they know their shit. But they would not have the PR sending a message to the rest of the world type credibility, right?
Sure. And a lot of these negotiations actually happen beforehand. Like, the deputies meet about a week before and hammer out the rough outline of a statement, or at least set an agenda to talk about over the course of a conference. This is like 2 or 3 days that they spend together, so it's, they've got a lot of time to talk about a lot of things, potentially. Yeah. Or to argue in circles around Donald Trump.
Man, that one picture, though, that was circulating.
He looks so petulant.
Of him sitting there, arms crossed, like, grimacing at Merkel as she is, like, projecting across the table. Oh, so great. That's just, like, honestly a great picture. That should win awards.
Right, and Abe didn't really think that anything was going to happen off of it, obviously.
Abe is, he seems to just be, I don't know, like, what is his agenda? What's his deal?
Maintain the U.S.-Japanese security alliance into the near term.
Yeah. And he seems kind of like make friends with everyone type. Is that not true?
He's more conservative than you might think.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I've heard there's like his party has a... they're not like the ultra-nationalists there, but they're nationalists, right?
Mm-hmm.
You call them. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, all right. That's a thing.
That's a thing.
So, what's going on in... Tell me what to think about Ethiopia and Eritrea.
Well, it's got to be one of them, like, in some ways, way more fascinating than anything else that's happening in international diplomacy right now, because about a week ago, the Ethiopian government announced that it was going to accept without condition a 2000 peace agreement that was outlined between them.
Okay, that struck me as highly unusual.
Oh, it is. Well, the new prime minister of Ethiopia, whose name isn't currently in front of me, but he's taking a line to really correct some of the mistakes of the past, because they're really impeding of Ethiopia's development and welfare.
I mean, to accept without condition? I mean, what is that?
Okay, so when Eritrea...
Presumably they haven't accepted it for, you know...
Well, for interesting reasons. Okay, so... Okay. The Eritrean-Ethiopian civil war peeled off, like, the northern quarter of Ethiopia and cut it off completely, turning it into a landlocked country.
Mm-hmm.
And so they fought that horribly vicious trench war for about a decade, and eventually it came to a stalemate, and they negotiated. Well, they tried to negotiate, and then eventually sent it to international courts, like the International Court of Justice. Well, the court that the UN uses to settle things like this. And okay. So the court agreed to, well, what Eritrea was saying, that they should have more of the land than they have, especially around the town of Badme, around the notional border.
Okay.
And yeah, it basically amounts to Ethiopia giving up a lot more than Eritrea would. And yeah, for the government to agree to this, it's kind of a sign.
A sign that they just want peace.
They want a more productive relationship. Yeah, of course. I mean, there is kind of peace. I mean, they're like a kind of a stalemate now, but it would be a lot better for both countries if they didn't have like hundreds of thousands of troops and military equipment deployed facing each other.
Well, and so, I mean, but wanting a more productive relationship seems kind of, if you just look at a map, you can kind of understand, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, because Eritrea is on the sea, Ethiopia's
landlocked.
And, you know, it's like, hey, why don't we have a good economic relationship with this country that stands between us and the sea?
Right.
So, but now there's this,
The problem was that the previous war got caught up in a lot of personality because Ethiopia is not exactly the most democratic government, especially in the past. And so it became really kind of personal for leadership to maintain that struggle.
But now, you had tweeted out this article, Eritrea, behind Eritrea's silence over Ethiopia's call for peace, by Zacharias.
Yeah, the government has announced anything, and I've been looking, but they haven't made even a statement about it yet.
And so why wouldn't Eritrea be like, yeah, let's do this? Because, I mean, as you just sort of said, you know, it should be theoretically beneficial for both countries.
Sure. For the Eritrean government, this war is kind of like the raison d'etre.
Mm-hmm.
If not for it, they would have to write and promulgate a constitution, which they haven't yet.
Mm-hmm.
They're ruling by dictate and fiat because they feel like they're in an existential war, or at least they're making their country feel like it is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we talked about Eritrea on a previous episode in terms of, I believe, immigration into Europe, mm-hmm. and how they were like sending. Wasn't that Eritrea? Sending, like, these spies, and they have, like, this militaristic government there where everyone has to serve until they're, like, in their 30s.
Yep, until they're 35,
so
at
that,
least.
That kind of seems like, in terms of, peace might help the country, but the government, or the dictatorship, might not.
It has no interest in it. Yeah, they have no interest in peace.
My uneducated take is that it seems like Ethiopia having such like a, okay, peace, no conditions, is kind of like something you would do knowing the other side might not accept, because they would have been acting in bad faith over those negotiations because they didn't really want them anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't really know where that leads. I can't really.
Yeah, there's no.
Go ahead.
The only way that goes is that further enhances the military outcome, which is like a parallel we'll talk about in a later part of the podcast. But yeah, we can kind of game this out. So Ethiopia's like, yeah, we'll agree to that, and Eritrea doesn't say anything. Or okay, so either they do say they agree to it, and Ethiopia's positions improve. They don't agree to it, and Ethiopia can use that as a pretext to just keep the lands that they're currently occupying, which is not a loss from their eyes. Or they don't respond at all, and yeah, the situation doesn't change. I mean, the only thing that could happen is fighting starts up again, but that doesn't seem likely.
Might Ethiopia be wanting to put, like, get other countries to put pressure in some way?
Maybe it's tough to put pressure on that country because they don't really have anything.
Yeah.
The United Arab Emirates, interestingly, has a base there along the Red Sea now. I've seen on several maps. That might be one avenue of pressure, but I don't think the Emiratis are going to care very much about Ethiopia. Eritrea's relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So
yeah, I guess we'll wait. I guess I'm going to have my eyes open waiting for the Eritrean statement, but I don't expect one to be forthcoming. And another part of this is that Ethiopia is probably getting itself pressured from the outside to resolve the situation.
Oh.
By, like, China and other economic sponsors who would like to have easier access or easier infrastructure to get into Ethiopia to help, you know, the development in their program.
How are they getting in now?
I think it's railway links through Kenya.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, obviously adds like hundreds of miles onto the trip.
Yeah, that's wild, because it's like that thin strip of land. Like, you have, I mean, they, I don't know exactly where the ports are in Eritrea, but you'd think there'd be one close enough.
There's one at Massawa, and another at Massab, just north of Djibouti.
Okay, yeah.
And I think that Emirati's base is in Beylul, just north of Assab.
All right. Let's talk about something kind of fun. These Swedish rules for information warfare. Because, you know, a country putting out a a pamphlet preparing their population for invasion by the Russians, which they haven't done in like 70 years, is super fun.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the Swedish government put out a new civil defense guide, which has a lot of kind of practical things in it, and it has information about, like, what was one thing, like, how to tell different, like, sirens and air raid horns and stuff like that apart. But it had an interesting bit about fake news and propaganda, which I believe Sweden has been experiencing. I mean, if my timeline is right, some of the first Russian, kind of in the Putin era, what do they call that? What's a fancy word for fake news and propaganda into another country?
Well, propaganda is the
Unsymmetrical warfare, asymmetrical warfare.
That's
the word I'm looking for. So I think they were doing some of that in, I don't know, like 5-6 years ago, I think.
In Estonia. I don't think it was Sweden so much.
I thought Sweden had something. I don't know. My internet is going super slow right now, so I'm just going to be winging it with facts.
Well, I know they had the huge denial of service attacks on Estonia, which, you know, caused everybody in Europe to take notice. And it's like, oh, we're going to electronic government, and it's still apparently really vulnerable.
Yeah. So anyways, in this civil defense guide, they talk about, here it is, it's called, Be on the Lookout for False Information,
mm-hmm.
And, it has some, like, questions to, ask yourself, and this is just, I think you pointed out, this is just great,
great rules to live by.
Yeah.
To read the news with.
Yeah. Is this factual information or opinion? What is the aim of this information? Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, that first one is very, very difficult to piece out sometimes. Like, a lot of news articles, like, will report something as fact, but if you look at it's just based on a lot of quotes and the individual opinions of the people quoted. So be careful with that.
Yeah. It's hard, which I think is why you kind of have to then bring in these other questions as well. You know what's another thing, though, talking about news more broadly, that I've been noticing is sometimes opinion articles, because they have a perspective, have valuable information. But that's a tough game to play, like, you know, all the time. Because then you're just kind of subject to the whims of opinion writers. But there are some good opinion articles out there.
Sure, like some people try to use facts and like coherent ideas and making opinions, and sometimes it's just propaganda.
Yeah, and well, I guess what I'm saying is sometimes they are able to form a narrative and get pertinent facts to show something that otherwise you as a reader would maybe not get to that conclusion based even if you read all the news articles, because there's just so much information out there that it's, you know, it's kind of what the opinion writer's job is, theoretically. And, you know, I mean, I'm not trying to defend opinion journalism in general, but sometimes it is valuable, and which is why then these other things become important, too.
Mm-hmm. Is well, especially source... when those people...
Go ahead.
When the people are, like, you know, experts in their fields, and of course they have a
yeah.
a perspective, but, you know, it's kind of valuable to know what the people involved are thinking.
Yeah, and a good one will be open about who they are and what they are. You know, like, if you're reading about the Trump-Korea nuclear summit, and it's some, like, guy who's, like, served in every Republican administration since, like, 1930, then, I don't know what his game is, but it's probably partisan. Whereas if you just hear about some guy who's, or lady, you know, of course, who's been, you know, maybe, like, has a varied career as a diplomat and a professor and shit, or is, like, an expert on nuclear arms or something. You know, that might be a little bit different and possibly more valuable. But it also has other questions here. Is the source trustworthy? Who has put this out? Is this information... I like this one a lot. Is this information available somewhere else?
Yeah, that means that's verifiable.
Yeah, and, you know, and then, but see, then, when you look for it other, in other sources, are they just getting it from the same source? Or, you know, but you can start... kind of what's that, triangulating information.
Right, they can triangulate its source a little bit, especially if two different news or articles from different news outlets both quote an anonymous source that speaks in, you know, the same, almost the same way.
Yeah, I, you know, it's kind of been interesting, you know, we bemoan fake news a lot and all that, but I've learned a lot about journalism in the past 2 years in terms of sourcing and how they source and, you know, being more savvy about that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's, well, journalism is private sector intelligence work.
Yeah, yeah. And then disseminating it to the public.
Yeah, instead of just the government or yeah. your interested party.
Here's another one. Is this information new or old, and why is it out there at this one you bring up a lot, and why is it out there at this precise moment?
Like, I guess I do bring that up a lot.
I mean, you do. You say, like, oh, it's old news, it's coming back, but I mean, sometimes there might be a good reason, sometimes there's a bad reason, but why, what is that reason? Why am I reading about this now when this is some thing that happened 4 years ago?
Yeah, there's been a lot of repeating news in the past year.
Yeah.
There's a lot of motivations behind this. Like, sometimes people are trying to, you know, ignite debate about something, get public interest in it, stir it again. The other problem is that bringing up the same old news again can, you know, keep oxygen from stories that are developing and things that are more pertinent in the current moment than what happened a year ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes I don't know, people forget things. You never saw it in the first... I don't know. I mean...
Or it's just a flash in the pan.
Yeah. Because it's kind of like... On one hand, it... Like, we shouldn't have to be so hyper-cautious about some, like, reading about something that happened a few years ago again. But, I mean, that's the world we live in. We just have to deal with it and be wary and savvy about things.
I mean, it's not like propaganda's new. You could just be reading, like, old propaganda that's just repackaged.
Yeah.
the best way to counteract propaganda and false information is to have done your homework, the Swedish guide says. Do not believe in rumors. Use more than one reliable source in order to see whether the information is correct.
That's, yeah, very important.
Yeah. It's tough, though.
Do not spread rumors is kind of, yeah, that's how information warfare kind of disseminates in that asymmetrical way. Like, it's sometimes difficult to map out exactly who is going to be the pivotal opinion or pivotal opinion to churn, because sometimes people can influence a larger group of friends than it may suggest by their social media profile.
Hip-hop test drive. We are getting in our car. We are turning up the bass, mid, and treble, and rolling a blunt, and putting in the new tracks to see how they sound in the proper hip-hop listening environment. Today we have, I would say, we're doing something a little different this week. We're doing three new albums. So actually, one's an LP, two are EPs. One is Gift of Gabs, he hasn't done anything in a while, right?
No, not in a minute. He had some, kidney problems and ended up having to have a transplant.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's too bad. Yeah. Well, it kind of makes sense. Now I get the name of his thing a little bit more, though. It's called Rejoice, Rappers Are Rapping Again.
I will say, he really touches on a zeitgeist with that. Ever since the Trump administration came back, we've had, like, Mr. Lift has put out two albums, Jean Grey put out an album. Like, everybody's coming back with a vengeance.
Yeah. That's awesome. We also have Black Thought, who is the longtime frontman of The Roots. His first solo effort, called Streams of Thought, Volume 1. And then we have Zarface meets Zarface and MF Doom album is called this is the LP Zarface meets Metal Face. MF Doom always has a metallic mask on, so that's that part. And Zarface is Inspect a Deck, and who's it a collab with?
Who's the DJ?
Oh,
7L and Esoteric.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Ba ba ba. But he's the only one that raps, right? Or do these other?
Yeah, I think they're both producers. So I think they're both on there.
Yeah, it sounds right to me. Anyway, so Inspect a Deck. I mean, to me, Black Thought, Gift of Gab, and MF Doom are three, like, legends. They would be, should be in most people's top, I don't know, whatever you want to, how big you want to make that top list, 10, 20, 50. Even if you're in the top 50 rappers of all time, that's, like, fucking awesome.
Right, because there are so many of them. Really, yeah. Deck isn't above Doom in your list?
I exactly knew you were going to say that. and so I already had a response. No, I don't think he is, because I'm not even sure he'd be in my top five favorite Wu-Tang members.
Wow.
But, I'm not even sure was he even an official Wu-Tang member?
Yeah, he's in the clan.
Okay, he is. Anyway, yeah, you're right. I don't know why I said that. Didn't he did, I think, my favorite verse of all time. Isn't that him that starts the first verse of Wu-Tang Forever? Which is like, abomatomically, Socrates' philosophies and hypotheses can't control how I be dropping these mockeries, lyrically performed dumb robberies.
Yeah, that's it.
I think that's expected, which is my favorite Wu-Tang verse of all time, one of my favorite verses of all time, period. So, I mean, he's up there. I just don't think the overall... Now, granted, I haven't listened to a lot of Zarface beyond this, so, and I like that. I was listening to a little bit right before this album came out,
just to be like hear what the sound is, and I definitely like it. It's awesome. So you know, I don't know. Maybe he's moving on up in his old age. But anyway, so I wanted to first let's do a quick thing about what we thought about each one, and then let's kind of talk about like these three, or if you want to extend it to four, legends and how they sort of what their best traits are and how why they're great. So let's start with which one do you want to start with?
I guess Zarface. I have it okay. Open in front of me.
All right. So Zarface and MF Doom's Zarface and Metalface. You know, I listened to a little bit of Zarface beforehand. I've listened to a fair amount of MF Doom. Their styles were already kind of similar.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of, like, the music and, like, the sampling that they both do.
Right? So
it only made sense. Well, I don't know. What did you think?
As you said, their styles are really comparable. Like, the ridiculously layered flow that they that Inspect a Deck and MF Doom employs just works so well together. It was just kind of a natural collab.
Yeah. I totally agree. It's almost like when I first heard Zarface, I was like, is MF Doom already a part of this somehow?
Or just naturally gravitating towards it.
It just seemed so much like Doom. You know, these comic references. Yeah.
I mean, Deck has been doing that from the beginning.
Yeah, well, in terms of like his verses, but I mean like the artwork and everything. Like all the Zarface albums look like comic book covers.
Mm-hmm.
And MF Doom has been doing that shit. I mean, he calls himself Doom and wears a Victor Von Doom mask. So he's been beyond the music itself, he's had this comic
really
book vibe. Yeah. I mean, I thought it was, full disclosure, I don't really have a lot of criticism for anything we're about to talk about today.
Yeah.
Because I guess
the one criticism that you could probably make is that there's like basically two lyrical structures that they use.
Sure.
It's couplets with punchlines.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I might push back on that a bit though. They both do a lot of internal rhyming, or like MF Doom does those kind of rhymes, which he does them in a less flashy way than we'll get to with Gift of Gab. But he does
pause raps.
Well, he does like 5-7 like long syllable rhymes, where like all seven syllables, like it could be multiple words, and it rhymes with essentially the next line and the next line. And like if you like wrote it out and kind of mapped out some of his rhyming schemes, like they're shockingly complex. He has a way of doing it that's not showy, which I don't know if that's better or worse, because it's like you don't even notice it some of the times. But then you're like, okay, he said blah 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 blah, and that's like the exact same cadence as the next line and the rhyme, and there's like three rhymes within those eight syllables or something. I mean, he's pretty technically good. He just has a style that seems like sloppy, I should say.
Hmm. Well, I mean, they both kind of harken back to, I'm sorry, the name currently escapes me. The Guru. Christ his soul.
Oh, ODB?
No, the Guru from Gangstar.
Oh, sorry.
Monotone timed rapping style,
especially MF.
Yeah, because they really play with time a lot with the pauses and divisions of time that they use.
Yeah, and it's like not like, and it's like meant to be nonchalant, like in style, but it's actually like not. I can see that from the Guru. Yeah, that makes sense.
Which is kind of what I like about the way you're structuring this, is that all three of them kind of hail from in different rapping styles, traditions of different rapping styles. And these two are definitely like the Guru.
Yeah, Let's just quick do the ODB. That's why ODB was on my mind. The ODB scale for judging this. I would say not very commercial on this one.
No, it's not really hardcore.
Not really. Yeah, not a little bit.
It's pure abstract.
It's heavily weighted towards abstract. Yep, I agree. Okay, let's move on to let's do Gab. So, okay. Gift of Gab of the legendary Blackalicious. He's been around since I think the late 90s.
Mid to late 90s, yeah.
Came to more prominence though back with when we were in college, early to mid 2000s. He did albums with Blackalicious and some solo ventures at the time. I mean, if you're an old underground head, you'd know him from what was it, Alphabet Aerobics and
Raising Arrow, album.
those tracks back then were huge. As much as for a novelty, you'd see early YouTube videos animating them and shit. So this is an EP. I don't have it open in front of me. There's
six albums, six tracks on it.
Six tracks. I haven't listened to Gab or Blackalicious. I mean, Blackalicious, I would have said at one point might have been my favorite rap group. I didn't even know why until you told me that earlier, why they haven't been doing stuff. But hearing him, when he comes in on that first song, I was just it was refreshing. It was jumping into like a warm pool. Just just enveloped me in his rhymes and his style, which I hadn't heard in so long. And I was like, yeah, this is why he is just amazing.
Right? He just has a natural charisma that I guess even MFM and Deck don't have.
No. Right from the beginning, his style is flashy. It's musical. It works with the rhythm, but in a... and I don't mean this as a critique, but in a mechanical way almost. He's like a rapping supercomputer.
He really uses that voice modulation,
and he,
which is why it's a good contrast to that guru type style that from Starface.
Yeah, no, he does. He it's just jumps out of the track at you. I think the production is fine to good.
Spot on.
None of it made me want to jam the track more than his verses, but I mean that just might be because his verses are so awesome. His rhyming, I think it's in that first track, it's the whole first verse is the exact same rhyme over. I mean, he might repeat a slight word, but it's I think ass crack, it's two long A sounds, and he does something 30 bars or something. I don't know. It's crazy. And then in the second one, it's a couple different rhymes, but it's kind of the same thing. It just pummels you with rhymes, and it's amazing he can get in that many thoughts in so few syllables when he's sticking to these tight rhymes. Someone who's written before, I can't write that. I could physically, I guess, rap that fast, I guess, if I think I could, but the writing is what gets me.
Yeah, it's so layered.
Yeah. I don't know. What were your thoughts on?
I liked the gentrification song personally.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was good.
Gift of Gab just brings another, tight offering where it's, both uplifting, positive, and ecstatic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Calling it Rejoice. Yeah, I mean, he has that. He's had a positivity since the beginning.
Yeah. And, I am rejoicing that rappers are rapping again.
Yeah.
But it's really not very much to say about it, because it's only six tracks, but, yeah. It's pure Gab.
Yeah, I mean, so I'm just, looking at the... So that first track I was referring to was Bowling Pins.
Mm-hmm.
It's not even 3 minutes long. And it just feels epic when you're listening to it, because there's so many words, so many rhymes, and he's just so
Chemical Calisthenics is only 3 minutes.
Oh yeah, if that. I don't even know.
If
you're right. Gentrification song was cool. Abominable has a great hook. Yeah. I don't. Is there any other rapper that he? Well, let me say, is there any other rapper that predates him or is more famous than him that he reminds you of? Like, he has Ari the Rugged Man on here, who he's collabed with for years, who is kind of similar. But I can't really think of someone who came before him that he reminds me of.
You know, I would say Slick Rick. He kind of reminds me of early Slick Rick in some ways.
Yeah.
Slick Rick would do that voice modulation thing while the whole New York scene was time division and repetition.
Yeah. I think the difference there, though, would be... He's more concerned with like a stylistic rhyming approach, whereas Slick Rick was like the legendary storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I could see that though.
I mean, it's tough because Gift has, you know, he brings a lot of different elements to it that, you know, not very many other rappers have brought.
I still like can picture in my head, I would feel like I'm there. The time where he was doing that, you were at the show too, where he was freestyling, a four-way freestyle. I can't remember all the people there, but yeah.
Latif was there. He was hype man that night, and wasn't it like two other people from Jurassic 5? I'm trying to remember who it was.
You have a better memory than me. I don't.
Because Chief Pixel wasn't there that night because his wife was giving birth.
Oh, okay. That was a very intimate show, too, because it was in a weird room that I'd never seen music in before or since.
But strangely large, like, way bigger than the Rascal.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. It was at the Union here in Madison. It was awesome. Okay, so then let's move on to, actually, probably the one that I've heard about the most.
Streams of Thought?
Yeah, Streams of Thought by Black Thought, because Black Thought's, he's... He's on TV every night. He's on The Tonight Show every night. So, I mean, he's a little bit more famous than, I think, these other guys, and more famous than he was beforehand. I mean, it's
kind of absolutely. Been... He's got a huge overground following now.
Yeah, he's kind of the roots. I mean, they've had hits in the past, sort of, but this has kind of pushed them...
Yeah, like, Homegrown is, like, pretty radical for its content compared to, even contemporary albums.
What was I going to say? Oh, before I get into this, did you see his freestyle a couple months ago that was circulating? It was like a 13-minute freestyle that he did on one of those morning kind of like rap hip-hop shows. It's like I've seen other guys freestyle on there, and it'll be like 45 seconds or something. It's like fine.
He dropped the first half of it was pre-written.
Oh, he dropped like three songs worth of shit though. Like Black Thought, it was just ridiculous. Like it was like this big viral video. Because
it was after record.
It was crazy. Like I've never seen that. You know, and some of it might be kind of. I mean, that's kind of what freestyling is, though, is, like, taking these thoughts that are in your head that you maybe have written at some point, but it's not, like, spitting a 13-minute written verse. Which, by the way, even if he did that in one take, that would be amazing.
Right?
it was crazy. Anyway, so, his style is, I don't know, what's his style reminiscent of?
The Watts Poets, kind of. Like, he's in some ways way more radical than Gab. Like, Gab kind of takes a, what you might say, a more philosophical aim at, negativity and not necessarily the impediments in American culture, but Black Thought has always been, like, one to name names and say exactly what the problem is.
Agreed.
Like, way more hardcore than Gift of Gab and Black Licious. And even arguably than Scarface, like they kind of touch on issues, but they come from such an abstract place that it's not like it doesn't even feel like a metaphor, much more than a metaphor. No direct allusion, you know.
I mean, he has that like Philly, kind of radical black. That's his roots, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
right. The roots, as it were.
Yeah, exactly. And he does not. He's very outspoken and does not pull punches. But man, you know what I was thinking though when I was listening to this? As much as like MF Doom is known for references and like this kind of like big vocabulary, and of course Gift to Gab is, you know, throwing the kitchen sink into his songs, I was astounded with this Black Thought album, this just short EP, about the number of like references that he like not just like throws it in for like rhyming purposes, but it means something and he gets the meaning right. And then he does it again the line after that, and again the line after that.
Mm-hmm.
It was, man, I was really taken aback by just how encyclopedic it was. Not necessarily like a human thesaurus and dictionary, but like encyclopedic. Like he's like a living Wikipedia of rap in rap verse form.
Well, he's obviously pretty well read, right?
Oh, Jesus. I mean, he named one of his songs Dostoevsky. yeah. I mean, it kind of seems like all three of these artists are air towards abstract, but I'd say his pushes more into hardcore.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a little bit merging. And then, I don't know, I mean, I wouldn't really call this, like, commercial, but as I was alluding to in the beginning, just based on his prominence right now in pop culture,
just because it has a commercial platform.
Yeah, it might be a little commercial. Yeah, I don't know, though. I mean, I would think that, like, Fallon, they would have had him perform one of these songs. I don't watch The Tonight Show, but I would guess.
I would imagine. Don't watch it either.
I would hope so. yeah, so I don't know. Anything else you want to...
Well, I'm really encouraged by this trend in hip-hop that more rappers are rapping again.
Sure.
It seems like the last few years that you maybe got a little bit more or too comfortable or apathetic, and now people care again, which is encouraging.
Yeah.
I mean, Taste of Chicago, what, later this month? I'm going to go see Black Star perform again, so that's huge.
Black
they got
Star,
Mos Def
really?
Back on stage. Yeah.
But he doesn't go by Mos Def anymore, though, right? He goes by...
I don't know the other name, and I'm not going to say it.
I don't remember his other... I feel bad. I just heard it yesterday. That's why it's, like, in my head. Yeah, so wait, Black Star, that's Mos Def and Talib, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, cool. Very cool.
Oh, Yasin Bey?
Yeah, that might
that's
be
his
it.
Real name.
I think that's what he goes by now, though.
That's interesting.
I'm pretty sure as a stage name, that's what he goes by. I think. Because I was listening to something yesterday that he did a track on someone's album coming up or something. And that's what they listed him by, not Mos Def. Maybe for the purposes of Black Star, though. You know, who knows? But yeah, so, like, where do you... You know, what got me about listening to these three albums this week is how good some of the old, like, the great old-timers still are.
I mean, KRS-One keeps dropping albums, like, every year.
Does he?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know, like, they don't sound tired, and, you know, like, okay, I've listened to, like, rock tracks. Think about, like, the difference between, say, Red Hot Chili Peppers, which, granted, are probably older than all of these guys, but Red Hot Chili Peppers in 1989 doing, like, funky-ass hard shit to a 2010 Red Hot Chili Peppers track that's just, like, these kind of, like, ballads almost.
Mm-hmm.
And not even really that interesting of ballads, just kind of like slightly slow rock songs that just like sound like they might as well just be U2 or something.
Yeah, there's no real progression evident.
Or it's, if anything, it's just, it's a progression towards blandness. And that's not happening in any of these cases.
No. I mean, these are, like, pretty much the best examples I've heard of some of these, rappers.
Yeah, there's no...
There's nothing missing.
Yeah, this is not... I don't know why that difference is. Like, why would a band, a rock band, get more tired and mainstream and boring, but an MC doesn't? And honestly, there. I mean, I can't even think of many MCs that have.
It's more about individual progression with MCs, though, than a rock band. Like, these are people who, you know, a lot of them have that personal ethos of personal development, so...
Yeah.
Hmm. And they're, I mean, pretty well dedicated to their causes.
Yeah.
Huh. I mean, well, Risa may be a director now, but Wu-Tang is, will always be forever, right?
Wu-Tang is forever. Even if it has side projects like Czarface.
I mean, maybe we should have an argument in a later episode about who's the best individual member, but...
Of Wu-Tang?
Who put out the best individual album of the Wu-Tang members?
Hmm. So that would have to be between GZA and Ghostface, right?
Or Meth.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know.
But
I don't...
yeah, I'd say GZA. Like, two hands down,
Chizza. Dude, I don't know, Ghostface is sick, though. Yeah, this would be a good art. Yeah, hopefully, maybe sometime this year, like, they'll kind of release, a couple of members will release something in the same month or something, and we can discuss it. Or whenever Martin Shkreli's Wu-Tang album comes out.
I'm surprised it hasn't already. Well, I guess it's sitting in sessions.
I think they're working on, I think there's an effort to get that done.
I don't care if you guys have to heist it out of the Department of Justice or offer him up a bribe. Or, like, Bill put so many lawyers in so many courtrooms that he eventually just gives up but release the album.
That would be an awesome movie. Like, it's like Ocean's 8 mixed with, or Ocean's 11, I don't know, whatever the original, or any of them, doesn't matter, they're all the same. An Ocean's movie mixed with, but with Wu-Tang Clan members, and they're playing themselves. And
obviously,
they have this, like, multi-pronged effort to get one of their albums out of, like, you know, FBI. Like, it'd be great. You can touch on, like, weird political, like, joking and, you know, their own unique personalities. Yet it's also sort of like a heist movie, so you just have, like, a built-in, easy-to-write plot. Ah,
I'd love to see, like, GZA or Inspector Deck try to visit Roy Moore to get him to influence Jeff Sessions.
It's so funny.
Like, Deck is just, or one of them just, like, has his hand on the weapon the whole time, and the other one just kind of, like, keeps him from drawing it. Like, I know you want to shoot this guy. Believe me, I really feel that, but we need his help.
Oh, it'd be great. Oh, it'd be so great. All right, anyway, enough writing Wu-Tang movies.
And trying to make demands, and like one of the aides or officials, not even an aide, but this is our fucking house.
Wait, who said that?
Somebody in the White House
said that about what?
Like, there was a, like, the Israeli ambassador to the U.S., Derner, like, was trying to dictate who we met with in the White House, and he wanted to meet with Flynn, the national security advisor, and like, response later was like, this is our fucking house. It's like, dude, you have the wrong opinion of fucking public service.
Wow. Yeah.
Especially, like, what was it? Like, America First Bitch?
What?
Yeah, didn't you hear about this? Like, somebody in the fucking White House was like, so what does America First policy even mean? And the only fucking response they got back was, America First, comma, bitch. Or bitches, depending on who you talk to.
What is...
What is the fucking wrong with you people?
What is happening?
I don't know, man. I'm trying to try to piece it together and let people know, but...
We are back with closing thoughts. We had some technical difficulties in our first segment, so if you thought that, hey, it seems like they should have had more thoughts about Swedish... fake news policy, well, you're right, and you'll never hear it. But the other part that got cut, we should start off with,
And I think it'll lead into a broader discussion of, I don't know, how would you put it, divisiveness on the left and the choices the electorate has to now make.
The terrible microeconomic position that Democrats are in, or in macroeconomic, or I'll say microeconomic because this is more about decision-making.
Yeah, it's easy to talk about it in a macro sense, but in the end, it's a micro. It's individual.
Like an individual choice. Like, yeah. You're trying to get individuals to move feet, so...
So let's just quick go over... this is the part we lost. so in Cuyahoga County, they had a party election for the new... Or for chairperson, and it was the person the incumbent won. What was her name? I have it here. Chantel Brown. She is a councilwoman there in Cuyahoga County, and it kind of pointed to this broader issue, which has been going on since 2016, I think is easy to say, between a more progressive, lefter wing of the Democratic Party, often personified by Bernie Sanders, although I actually have got an impression that it's more radical than him, to be honest.
Yeah, he's not necessarily the most radical leftist anymore.
No, not at all. And not saying, like...
That's not a judgment of anybody's opinion.
Yeah. It's just, correct. So, anyway, it seems like there is an electability issue.
Or perception of electability.
Yeah. But now, in some cases, that is... You brought up California.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of being borne out, because, you know, Allison Hartson should have, as I said in the infamous last, or now infamous last segment, she should have gotten more votes in California than she got. Like, there was just kind of a dearth of progressives up and down the ballot that just apparently didn't show up to vote. I don't know why.
Which is surprising in California, being a bastion of at least the Democratic Party, if not just liberals.
That's kind of tough to argue. There are states that are way more liberal. There's like Nixon was from California. So there's
That was also 50 years ago.
I mean, San Bernardino is still as conservative as ever. Probably one of the most conservative spots in the country outside of Waukesha.
But, yeah, and there's money, of course, for that there. But, I mean, in terms of their statewide offices and their legislature. I mean,
it's pretty left and progressive.
But you're right. They even had, so on one hand, they had Arnold Schwarzenegger, Republican, as their governor, 10 years ago or something? But even he wasn't...
A dyed-in-the-wool Republican.
Yeah, I mean, even he was a little bit different, moderate, compared to a lot of them. I mean, it's not like they're electing Reagan as their governor, and probably not anytime soon.
No.
It's actually interesting that the politics of kind of anti-immigration don't seem to really work there, which would be the place, if this was a big deal, would be one of the places it would be most powerful, you'd think.
Well, yeah, but like every industry in California relies on some form of immigration, like the agricultural sector, which is like a fifth of their economy, and they're already a fifth of our economy,
yeah,
of the national economy. So,
yeah,
it depends on migrant labor. You have Silicon Valley, which depends on H-1B visas. You got industry, which again depends on some form of immigrant labor.
Yeah. Pardon me. Let's try and lay out this idea of the I'm going to use the word the resistance, but I don't think we're using that term directly overlapping with, like, the hashtag on Twitter.
Because that funder blocked me.
Well, that's a very practical reason why we're not doing that. No.
And I just, I think it's, I would, maybe we should say the opposition.
Yeah.
The opposition to the main party in power and the Trump administration specifically is now, well, yeah.
I guess that's kind of the cleavage there in the resistance. It's like, because some progressives are like, we're the resistance because we're like, you know, trying to move the entire establishment status quo into something else. And some of the more establishment Democrats are claiming that they're the resistance because they're the ones fighting Trump.
Yeah. Allegedly. Yeah. Well, and so I think when, like in 2017, early on, there was an opportunity to push hard as an opposition party on certain issues,
mm-hmm.
rather than kind of just like vaguely, broadly anti-Trump.
Yeah. I mean, because that is really not accomplishing anything.
Yeah, if, I mean, and, you know, people see through that, you know. It's like, well, and it was why are we anti-Trump?
And what I got to say, it was encouraging that so many people showed up to the airports with,
yeah.
with a Muslim ban. I mean, that was actual resistance.
Yes. And, well, and it, let's even put, there were a lot of protests around repealing the ACA.
Mm-hmm.
Which was a very specific issue-oriented thing.
Although, but they lost on that.
kind of. I mean,
yeah.
They lost the one bit that was put into the tax scam, but, I mean, you can still have health insurance through the ACA.
Yeah, you can still buy it.
And that has not been repealed, even though there are still efforts underway to do that. But it's now gotten to a point where, how did you put it? How the Trump administration is going even more radical in some of its policies?
Yeah, they're doing like the family separation thing. And here, let me pull up my email to get the exact. But yeah, he's getting kind of fascist on his in his policies. Here, let me read this. Now that we're in election season, it's no surprise that we're seeing some of the worst Trump-era policies promulgated to date. As of this writing, which was this weekend on Saturday, two people had lost their lives due to two tines of the terrible fork that is Trump's immigration policy. Like, one of the Dreamers who was deported was murdered in Mexico, and a Honduran immigrant who was separated from his family committed suicide in a jail in South Texas. Having ceded the intervening year to marginal resistance that ultimately allowed the tax scam, the 2018 ND National Defense Authorization Act, and numerous other bills to come to fruition, we are now left in a disadvantageous position of having to expend energy on electoral policy or politics rather than any broad or direct action against the actions of a creeping fascist, which are two distinct and different battles.
Yeah, and I think that's that's the crux of what's happening. And we might even disagree on the importance of either side, but I mean, that decision right now is being forced upon the electorate.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, like to me, it gets to, it's now getting to the point where there has to be this, it's like the voters have to start considering, political questions more than social questions, as a term I've used before that we that I got from the Revolutions podcast with Mike Duncan, which has been referenced before, because like there's all this rule breaking by the administration and there's all these like inhumane things they're doing, and it's like you can't even like it's hard to even form a political movement around, like, a positive change right now. Like, to... Like, Medicaid... Like, how often is that Medicaid for All even being really discussed? Because there's so many bad things that are happening that you have to, like, be against.
I mean, that's kind of the time when you need to talk about reform, though. Like, because even just pushing back against these policies is only going to go... like, so far to correcting what is obviously a problem.
Mm-hmm.
We have, yeah. We can't just keep relying on Zeno's paradox to deliver us closer to some ambiguous middle ground.
Well, and how much now are the politicians, I think this is also what you're referencing, how much time and energy now are the politicians going to be spending on campaigning and fundraising?
Now that summer's coming. I mean, Congress is going to be in recess, so we're going to have the problem of recess appointments, too. Trump is going to staff the bureaucracy with every living, breathing... I mean, they're probably not all pederasts and terrible people, but...
Maybe. I don't know.
I mean, I don't... We've had people, like, escorted out of the White House because they were... What, was that guy charged with murder, I think? Or he was suspected of murder?
Wait, yeah. Who?
No, there was, like, one of the lower-level officials a couple weeks ago that was escorted out by the Secret Service for being involved in a homicide or something of that nature.
Fucking balls. Yeah. And it's just... I don't know. They're not having the August recess in the Senate, right?
Which really disadvantages our particular senator. Like, that's going to hurt her more than almost anybody.
I totally agree, and I think that's intentional. I mean, not necessarily direct just because of Tammy Baldwin that it's being done, but...
I mean, but that's what their easiest pickup that they see this year, and I'm not sure they're wrong.
Yeah. Hey, let's transition into Uline on that one. So we've talked about the Uline political donation machine in, I think it was like our second or third episode. It was really early on. And involved in America's PAC in Wisconsin, and particularly backing the Kevin Nicholson campaign for the Republican nomination to run against Tammy Baldwin, the Democratic senator from Wisconsin.
Our primary is in August, if you're not from Wisconsin.
Oh, it is in August. Okay, I didn't even know that. Yeah, it's super. Jesus. Yeah, she's going to be busy that month. And so, there was an article in the New York Times, I believe, about, it was, do you think that was a really good article? I thought it was like a really...
it was kind of, I wish they would have gotten into what Uline, you know, their government contracts and other entanglements a little bit more, but, like, have those increased in the past couple of years? Have they reduced?
Sure. Yeah, that's interesting. Although... It did make a point that he hasn't necessarily backed that many winners.
Oh, yeah, he's got a terrible track record. Like, even worse than our revolution.
It talks about... it's by Stephanie Saul and Danny Hakim from the New York Times, as I said. It gets into their political donations. A lot of it's going to this Kevin Nicholson. He's kind of their hand-picked outsider conservative candidate. It talks about their company's involvement in Manitowash Waters, which is
That's their personal involvement.
But it's sort of like a little town that they are like bending to their whims. Well, mostly the wife, it sounds like, Mrs. Uline. But yeah, they're throwing out a lot of money right now. It would be something to watch who their money is going towards. The PACs affiliated are America's PAC and Club for Growth,
which is the Club for Growth,
an anti-tax group that supported.
That's Grover Norquist's group.
Oh, it is, okay, yeah, that makes sense. They also were the main backer behind Scott Walker's presidential run. I would guess that means they're backing his gubernatorial run, too. I don't think it says that.
I might not be so sure of that.
You think?
I don't necessarily. No, I don't. Like, Scott Walker has done some things recently to me that suggest he doesn't necessarily have the mega donor support in the way that he once enjoyed.
Yikes. Sucks for him.
I mean, that's kind of behind that populist $100 per kid program.
Yeah, that could
be. You think he would have needed to do that if he didn't have, like, millions of dollars on staff? No way.
Yeah. He the last thing I'll mention about their kind of, they also got heavily, the Mr. U line got involved in, like, school boards in Northern Illinois and things like that to push anti-transgender candidates. They quoted one guy in here who's like, yeah, I took money from them. I would never do that again. That was a huge mistake.
Yeah, he's like a real aggressive, like, maybe a bigot. I mean, I guess if you look at his policies, it's pretty bigoted.
Sure. Yeah. What did you think about the parts of the story that referenced how Mrs. Uline sends out these, like, newsletters to employees that, like, they quoted someone who's like, it wasn't so much, like, promoting her political beliefs, but, like, still...
It's just making it known.
Yeah, informing you of her political beliefs. I don't know.
What's that problem of moral capture, right? Like, eventually, somebody who works in an organization will... Their own ethics will come to mirror the ethics of the people at the top because they perceive that in the interests of, well... narrowly and selfishly their own interests, and secondarily the interests of the company.
Yeah. Might have a bit of a Stockholm syndrome thing going on, too.
Yeah. And a lot of virtue signaling.
Yeah. It didn't really... The article didn't get that much into... more into the Wisconsin Senate race beyond just kind of mentioning that they are backing this Kevin Nicholson guy.
Yeah, they didn't really expressly tie it to Wisconsin as much as, well, I mean, they kind of did, but not in the specific issues that they've been so heavily involved in, as you said.
Yeah, I mean, but I don't know. I mean, this is... Most of Mr. Uline's donations to these three PACs went towards the Wisconsin Senate race. As of May 31st, 2018, it's something like 20 million or something, and 7.5 went to the Wisconsin... I mean, how much money has Nicholson even raised? It can't be that much. 7.5 came from one guy, funneling it through these other PACs, at least.
I mean, I imagine people would be probably backing Leah Vuckmeer before him, right? I mean, other than that, tasteless advertisement she put out a couple weeks ago.
Oh yeah, about Tammy. Yeah, I get an impression that Kevin Nicholson would not be running if not for this single contributor backer, which is really dangerous.
Yeah, right. We're getting paper candidates now. I mean, Trump kind of was a paper candidate, but at least he was notionally independent.
Well, you know what I'll say about Trump, though, is, say what you will about him, but he didn't have a domestic... I mean, depending on how the Russian investigation goes with terms of foreign backers, he didn't have a main domestic backer initially. He actually won a lot of them over through the campaign, through getting the nomination.
Wait, wasn't Uline one of the first people to support him, though?
No, it talks here how they backed Walker and then Cruz and then but very similar to the Mercers.
Who was the bit support Trump initially? Like, he got one of the backers and it wasn't Adelson.
Adelson?
No, Adelson
The Kochs weren't into him right away.
He just kind of won over the party. Interesting.
But that being said, once he did get it, they became, like, cult members of it. I mean, some of these billionaires... Or I shouldn't say cult. I mean, they know who... They're pulling the strings, don't get me wrong. But but they became huge, like, backers. Like, they didn't hedge their bets. Once they went in with him, they're like, they're all in.
Well, they're trying to outbid each other at auction.
Yeah. All right. Did we have? We didn't talk about Korea and Trump in the first segment, did we? I can't remember now.
I don't think so.
So what's going on? So they released a letter this morning.
Yeah, like a joint, kind of a joint statement.
Yeah.
It didn't mention disarmament. Like,
well, didn't it say complete denuclearization of the peninsula?
I gotta pull this letter up.
So I believe the only thing that kind of got into anything remotely close to, like, the actual issues was Trump and the U.S. is going to back some sort of security guarantee or something for North Korea, and the North Koreans will push for complete denuclearization of the peninsula, which to me makes it sound like the Americans are pulling out. Like, if this all went ahead on this trajectory, which is I'm highly skeptical of.
Not necessarily. We haven't had nuclear weapons in there since, like, the 90s.
But aren't there, like, nuclear subs just offshore? I mean...
Well, like... Yeah, but in South Korea also... 99% sure, also already has, like, nuclear reactors. They're talking about purely missile technology.
Okay.
Like, you know, weapons tech, I assume. I don't, but... It doesn't... The one thing that I've heard is that Trump apparently talked about building hotels on Korean beaches.
Shut up, really?
Yeah. Like, he apparently talked at length about it.
That's probably all they fucking talked about.
Yeah, because they were only in the room alone for 45 minutes. That was going to be 2 hours, but they shortened it to 45 minutes. Oh, and, yeah.
Oh, I don't... I'm a little sickened, actually, right now. And I'm not like that.
Like, I mean, in a different... If it were somebody else, you'd be like, oh, he was talking about how they could get some economic development, because tourism... is a good, like, base level development.
He's talking about Trump hotels, though.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's... Like, he's talking about how he will personally benefit.
Oh, my God. He's getting played, right? Isn't he?
Well, I mean, by which side? I mean, on one hand,
I don't
know. Bolton is, like, right there at his elbow, and when this goes south, which it probably will, and nothing will become of this summit in terms of diplomacy, they're going to go with... the hammer or the mustache. And there's not going to be any oxygen left in the room for diplomacy, because they'll be like, well, we tried that and he told us to go fuck ourselves, so let's hit the button.
And they're making such a show of the diplomacy, but it's also like they're sort of letting Trump
fail in his own merits.
Yeah, and like speak his, like, some of his quotes beforehand were like, like, Beth and I were watching something at the news last night, and it was like, it is as cringy as I've seen Trump be. Like, yeah, talking about, like, I'll use touch and feel on him.
Like, dude, that's not even a negotiating strategy in business. That's,
And he said as earnestly as humanly possible, oh, I'll know within the first minute whether or not we can do this. Like, it was just Trump to the extreme.
Yeah, I mean, and what is work? It's like, I don't really see this as like a yes or no prospect. It's just a matter of how much cooperation we can get and how much this will move forward. I mean, I guess it's, oh, wow, that's interesting. I just watched Kim, I'm sorry to lose my train of thought, but I just watched Kim and Trump's handshake, and, you know, Trump has that weird thing where he, tries to command the interaction by, like, worse, like, jolting the person, like, trying to take charge of the handshake, and Kim Jong-un didn't even budge.
Oh, he's strong.
Yeah, like he just, like...
a bear.
But I'm sorry, I lose my point. What was I saying?
I don't know. Somehow that probably fit in with it.
Yeah.
no, I mean, so it's a big PR stunt that is, likely to fail. The hawks know it's likely to fail. They will use that as ammunition for being hawks.
Mm-hmm.
What is the Korean, North Korean? I mean, they're not
what,
idiots.
Is their next
move? Yeah.
They've got to go back to the Blue House in Seoul to talk with the South Korean president. like forthwith. Like, okay. The, like, things between the Americans and the North Koreans aren't necessarily going to move anything, but the facts on the ground, like, between the Koreas are what's really going to make progress, or be the sign of progress, at any rate.
You know what? If this leads to peace, which I'm highly skeptical of, but if it does, I think... Why is it, why do we live in this world, I know the answer to this, where Trump would be the one who gets the Nobel Peace Prize and not Kim Jong-un?
Or the South Korean president. Yeah. I mean, he obviously is the one that deserves it.
Yeah.
Because we live in a celebrity-fueled alternate reality.
Well, it's also a it's an award given by a Western European white nation. Not saying they don't ever give the award to people who aren't white, but when it is something like this.
Yeah. Oh, Moon Jae-in, sorry.
South Korea.
President Moon Jae-in.
Yeah. All right. Speaking of Trump's erraticism, is that a word? Erratic nature. I just like this story. We don't need to spend a lot of time on it. Of him tearing up papers that need to go to the National Archives.
No, that is so so huge.
And then the National Archives people were fired this past week, or recently at least.
And it hasn't really been reported, but that's got to be part of the. They're looking for leakers, right? They're trying to fire everybody they think might be leaking.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah.
It's like, oh, you people have seen all these records. You're probably leaking to the press, so you're fired.
So are they going to hire, like, some sycophants for the...
I mean, I imagine they probably want nobody to do that work.
That's... Oh, God, I don't know. My outrage fuel is low. But come on. So, like, it's just another norm. I mean, that's law, right? That's not even a norm.
Yeah, there's a Presidential Records Act where, like, basically any piece, well, like, most of the pieces of paper that come across his hands, especially, well, basically all the ones that aren't expressly personal are supposed to be recorded and preserved for history.
So, okay. Here's one thing. There's been all this talk recently about, you know, you can't indict the president. All of these things are political questions which get solved through impeachment. Why is there no consequence beyond impeachment for breaking laws that are made for the president? So it's one thing
What the hell is the point of making a law that prohibits the president from doing something when you can't really inflict consequences on him?
Yeah, without, like, a huge impeachment, debate and votes. And, like, that's a huge process. And, you know, it seems like a kind of ridiculous... Like, no one's even saying, like, I'm not even proposing, like, oh, you can't be president if you tear up these papers and break the law and try and, you know, not get them into the archives, but... I don't know, like some sort of consequence.
Right.
I don't even know what.
At least a fine.
Yeah, like you have to, yeah, fine, that would be good. Or some, I don't know, something like...
Yeah, well, it's un-American to constrain the power of the executive, so...
But yeah,
that's what I'm with.
This National Archive thing is really getting me too, because I just love this image of... 50 years from now, some researchers going through some of these declassified archives, and they're like looking at like the original papers, or even scans of the papers, and they're like, okay, here are all these reports that Obama was getting, and they get to the Trump ones, and they're like taped together and just like ripped apart, and it's like
these are just still in a garbage bag.
It's perfectly symbolic of like everything.
Oh, man.
Just the fractured, chaotic nature of it all. Just
talk about like a born criminal, though. Like if he was doing that as a businessman, that would also be a problem.
Yeah, yeah.
That's potentially destroying evidence. And if that was his normal mode of operation, then yeah, he's used to covering his tracks.
Yeah, because I don't even know. Like, at least the portrayal in the article, which I should give attribution. The portrayal in the article seems to be that it was, it's almost like he couldn't help it. Like, mm-hmm. he just did it naturally.
That's just what he does.
And, you know, I don't know. It's hard to get into someone else's head. These are just quotes through the people that they're interviewing, but it kind of makes sense. Yeah. So, by the way, this was reported by Annie Carney in Politico. it's just wild. Oh, my God. They have a picture on here on this political article. He has 45 etched into the cuff of his white shirt. They have a close-up of his hands as he's signing something. And on his, at least his left cuff of his white shirt, you know, it's coming out from the jacket. It has 45, like,
embroidered into it?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, coming soon at maga.com.
Yeah.
You can wear the 45 shirts.
I mean, are taxpayers paying for these individualized shirts, or are these gifts from the tailoring, big tailoring?
Or just prototypes from the Trump organization?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Let's hit up Yemen, and then we'll finish up. So, Yemen, you had tweeted out a thing that kind of made you think there's more going on in Yemen with the U.S. than before?
Hang on one second. I thought we were talking... When I think of Yemen right now, I am thinking about the incipient attack on Hodeidah by U.S.-backed forces.
I mean, so this is U.S. CENTCOM provided details about more airstrikes.
Oh, right. The U.S. Central Command just released details on unclassified a bunch of details about their airstrikes that they've conducted, especially in Yemen. Like, when you look at the list, it's like basically half, or like 5/8 maybe, or when you look at other collection centers, like Long War Journal and other people who keep track of these, about 3/8 of them aren't listed, which means those are probably classified due to being close air support missions. Like, they're helping troops on the ground, and their presence is still classified, so the strike in support of it is still classified.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it appears pretty extensive. It roughly centers on 3 provinces. I'm not going to destroy their names, but...
Yeah.
That American Special Forces have been known to operate in the past. Like, that's one of them was where they had that terrible first strike that killed a little American girl and a bunch of other people, recklessly.
Yeah.
And now...
This graph they have in this article in Long War Journal showing that spike in number of strikes in 2017. It's like 3 times the number of strikes as in 2016.
Yeah. Trump said he was taking the gloves off, and that means relaxing the rules of engagement and allowing lower-level commanders to call in more strategic assets in support of their operations.
Oh, wild.
But yeah, the main humanitarian port, Hodeidah, which is still under Houthi control, is UAE troops and their allies are like... Last report I heard, they were like 6 miles, about 10 kilometers away from the city.
Oh, okay.
It's the main humanitarian lifeline, and it's been a spot for, you know, internal refugees to gather.
Yeah.
So if any military attack on that city is going to kill literally thousands of people, and perhaps tens, if not hundreds of thousands more indirectly because of the cutoff of aid to Yemen, where, like, millions of people are food insecure. Tens of millions.
What happens if, the rebels lose? Like, what, is there going to be a government that's like a puppet of, like, UAE and Saudi Arabia, or?
Assumedly, Hadi will, yeah, the Saudi-sponsored government, at least, will notionally take central control over the country.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. But this has been a long-running problem.
Yeah, yeah. All right.
As usual, ending on a pressing note.
Well, I was actually going to end on something maybe not more depressing, but...
Oh, okay. So it's even more depressing.
No, not... Yeah, I don't know. It's debatable. Personally, a little maybe more depressing, but... this past week, as is probably everyone knows, Anthony Bourdain took his life in France. And, I don't know, I just kind of want to end it with, like, a little bit of a... I don't know. What did he mean to you? Tell me what to think about Anthony Bourdain to you.
Well, I mean, I'm trying to remember when I first started watching Anthony Bourdain. But yeah, I've never seen any other show that comes quite to the, like, even resembling the kind of tourism that I enjoy when I'm overseas.
Oh, yeah.
Like, because going to the fancy restaurants is interesting, but it doesn't really tell you what the country is about or what the people think.
Yep.
It's yeah.
No, that's a good point.
And a lot of those are Anthony Bourdain made international travel more approachable to the average person, I think.
Yes.
As he kind of, like, tried to dispel the myth that there is basically anywhere in the world that people can't go. Like, that guy went to some places that Americans would typically regard as dangerous, uncomfortable, dirty, whatever you want to call it, and he was there. Like, he had noodles with President Obama in a street-side Vietnamese noodle shop, where one of those places where they had plastic chairs and, like, yeah.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it's just such a powerful image to me because that's, to my mind, closer to, like, diplomacy and, like, reaching out to other societies should look like.
Yeah, I was listening to an interview with him this past weekend, and an old interview, and he talks about in it, how he would go overseas and meet with, you know, as you said, like, just meet with all types of different people and different cultures and all this. And a lot of times you have to kind of shed your biases and
preconceived notions.
Yeah, and not just, like, you have to, like, acknowledge they have a different culture and you can't just apply all of your standards to it. And actually, it was interesting, he's then talked about why he kind of developed a little relationship with Ted Nugent. And he's like, well, if I can go overseas to someplace, let's say, in the Middle East, and I don't even know what this dude's views on women are, but I probably won't like him, but, you know, we still share a meal and we have a bond. He's like, why can't I do that with people in the United States? Like, I don't have to agree with them to still form some relationship. And he's like, and I don't. He's like, I pretty much across the board do not agree with Ted Nugent, except we both like barbecue. You know, like,
that's nothing more American than that.
You know, and then that's, and he's like, so what, you know, and I thought that was, I don't know, kind of inspiring. He's like, why, if I don't let those, you know, my political stances and beliefs stand in the way of me going to meet with someone in another country, why should I let it stop me here? And I don't know. I mean, that struck me because, like, I could easily see myself letting that stand in the way of me at times.
I mean, yeah. When you don't talk to certain people because you know if you bring up certain things, they're just going to end up arguing.
Yeah. But, you know, hey, if you're both, like, feeling a bunch of, you know, I don't know, whatever good food makes your brain do, dopamine or something like that. If you're feeling that, then, you know, you can probably have a much more
Your blood pressure can't be raised if all of your blood's in your stomach trying to process a heavy meal.
Yeah, exactly. excuse me. Bourdain, he didn't, because he wasn't really like a TV chef in any traditional sense. Really more traveling, as you pointed out. He didn't really like, you know, teach me how to make good food. I didn't watch, you know, a show to learn how to make a certain meal the right way. It was really like an appreciation. Like, he had this like ability to communicate appreciation and how to appreciate. As you said, a lot of it was like immersing yourself in different cultures. You know, like this kind of food in this country is good just in, because it's like what real people are doing there. And I don't know, like, that's really stuck with me. I think he also kind of has like he made appreciating food cool.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that honestly wasn't a big thing. You know, like, food nerd culture has been like this like big thing, especially with like Instagram. Like, you know, it's become cliche, people taking pictures of meals, food porn.
Sure, that's still kind of new.
Yeah, I mean, but that didn't really, I'm not saying there wasn't any of it. I mean, we've had Taste of Home magazines for, I'd show you food porn.
Well, that wasn't, but that was still kind of marginal. That was for housewives.
Yeah, exactly. It wasn't directed towards like the cool culture, the culture of cool and what's hip and what is trendy. And it just wasn't as much a part of that. And he, as much as anyone I can think of, pushed it that direction.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of because he has this, like, you know, I was into, I don't know, punk music and drugs and, you know, smoking cigarettes and staying up late and drinking beer. And, you know, he has an appeal to him that is both kind of like clichély hip, but also real and understandable. And just an excellent communicator of appreciation and what, how to view food and how to taste food and how to eat it, even. Like, you talk about in some episodes, like, how to eat it. He would literally talk about, like, this is how you're supposed to do this. And it never seemed elitist at all.
Mm-mm.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah, every man quality that people lose once they become famous.
Yeah, he didn't, and I don't know. I mean, I still, and I kind of don't want to know.
Like, I don't know why he committed suicide.
The story. I don't know if there is one. I don't know. You know, he
does that serve to does that serve to make his legacy more appealing to the future? I don't think so.
Does what serve?
Oh, how, like, limit or making more public how he died. Oh,
sure,
and
sure,
why?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's just a personal struggle, right? And it should be, I don't know. I mean, I would leave that more up to, like, family if they had any. Like, if they wanted to publicize it. I don't feel that there's a great public interest needed, as you said, to, like, serve his future legacy. I don't know. All right. Well, this has been Tell Me What to Think. We made sure to end on a sad note. Hopefully you're quiet and thinking to yourself right now, mulling things over, maybe feeling...
I mean, it's a strangely positive dark. I think we're coming around the other end.
That's true. That was a little bit like, yeah, we talked about the positivity of his legacy. You're right. Yeah. You can reach us at tmwtt@gmail.com, Twitter @bloatednemesis, @green_weird, WYRD. Find us on all the platforms. Please leave us reviews, message us, tell us you like us, tell us you hate us.
If you want to
go ahead,
listen to older episodes, go to stoneduckmedia.com.
absolutely. Here
are leave comments there.
Hear how we were all over Uline and America's Pack before New York Times was. Yeah.
Man, we're a couple weeks ahead of the media seemingly on some of these.
We were months ahead on that one.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the only reason I recall the reason we got onto that is because I kept hearing commercials for it. But, you know, hey, we're hearing those commercials before anyone from the New York Times has any fucking idea about it. No offense to the New York Times, but, I mean, they're not living in Madison, Wisconsin. They're not living in the flyover battleground purple state. So.
Yeah, well, New York can wait for a couple of years to be behind Madison.
Yeah, I know,
so
yeah.
Many other things.
Like, politics are kind of going the other direction as opposed to, like, you know, music culture and stuff.
I mean, you guys may have gotten the onion, but you took it from us.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We will see you next week.
Today's sunny. Today's rain. Destroy the myth that will break our chains. Break your chains!